right, guys. Well, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems, and welcome to my first in this teleseminar series. Going to go over a pretty popular subject, core training, and specifically mountain bike core training, and going to kind of explain what is core training, so we're all on the same page with it. I think that's important because it can mean different things to different people, and so I just want to make sure everybody understands what I'm talking about when I'm talking about core training, and then kind of get into how does, you know, core training, you know, both specifically for the core and also how it relates to the rest of our movement and stuff like that, and then how that kind of is going to apply to our mountain biking. And so that's really the most important thing, is how does all of this stuff apply to the trail, and how is it going to make us better riders and have more fun and increase leg power and decrease back pain and all those other good things that having a good, strong, stable core can do for us. And so starting off, you know, what is the core? And, you know, it used to be back in the, you know, in the 80s and early 90s that we didn't necessarily talk about the core. We talked about the muscles that made up the core. And for most people, that is, you know, the abdominals, our obliques on the side of the core there, and then our low back area. And so most of the time when people are talking about the core these days, that's kind of the area that they're referring to. And I've actually got a little bit different definition of that, and again, I'm, you know, getting this from people much smarter than me, but realistically, the core is the center of our body. It's realistically the platform from which we create movement, and that's, you know, kind of the essence of it. And so if you cut off your arms, heads, and legs, then you would have your core. And so this also includes a couple areas that aren't necessarily, you know, included in most people's definition of the core. And so we also have our upper back muscles, the particular, you know, basically the muscles that keep our shoulder blades pulled back and stabilized for upper body movement. And then it also includes our hips. And so that's also part of our core. And so core training is basically, you know, strategies and training strategies that are going to work on this area. And so the other thing that core training, you know, brings about is it's not a muscle group, but it refers to a collection of muscles, and more specifically to how those muscles function together. And so I think this, you know, that actually kind of signifies an important shift in the way that people look at training. And like I mentioned, you know, back in the old super bodybuilder days in the, you know, 80s and early 90s and stuff, it was all about trying to look at each muscle individually. And so that's why, you know, the term core didn't necessarily exist back then. But what it does is reflect our better understanding of how the human body functions, and particularly, you know, functional anatomy is, you know, one of the terms used to describe this new understanding. And another thing, a concept that's been popularized by a few people, most notably Mike Boyle, who's a really well-known strength coach in the industry, is what's known as a joint-by-joint approach to training. And so basically, like I said, the old way to train muscles was to look at each muscle and train them the same way. You know, basically we would try to find an exercise that got that muscle to move, and then we would use sets, reps, and load to strengthen the muscle through that movement. And, you know, what we understand now is that what you want to do is you need to train each joint for its specific function in the movement chain. And basically our muscles don't act independent of each other. And so what you want to do is look at, you know, how is movement created, and how does each joint work together to create this movement? And so, you know, some joints want to be mobile and some joints want to be stable. And so you can't just train every joint the exact same way. And so, you know, basically starting from the ground up, you want to have stable feet and mobile ankles. I think most people would agree that having overly stiff and overly tight ankles, you know, tends to hinder movement. So we want mobile ankles. We want a stable knee joint. You don't want an overly mobile knee. It's, you know, called an ACL tear. We want mobile hips. And so, again, we want to be able to move freely from the hips. you know, moving up one joint at the low back, the lumbar spine area, we want that to be stable. We want that to be able to resist movement. And then, you know, the next joint up is our thoracic spine area, and we want that to be mobile. We want that to be able to move freely. And then we want stable shoulders. And basically with the shoulders, the trade-off is they're the most mobile joint in the body, but that means that they can get pulled out of position and put into, you know, positions that they don't function in as well, and that's why a lot of people get shoulder issues. It's not necessarily that their shoulders are weak. It's that their shoulders are unstable, and they get pulled out of position easily, and so that's how injuries and stuff occur. And so basically, as you can see from that example, that you've got a series of stable and mobile joints stacked on top of each other. So when we're talking about the core, you know, we've got a couple joints in there, but we'll just start from the center, which is, you know, the low back area, the lumbar spine, basically the area that most people think about. And that area there, we want to be stable. And so we have to train that area with those demands in mind. And you know, most of the time when people hurt their lower back, it's because they've moved under load, or they've moved under load and you know, moved at the lower back so many times that they've just worn it down, and then you get, you know, the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back sort of thing, where you're just like bending down to pick up your kid and all of a sudden your back just goes out. So if your lower back is stable and not moving, then odds of it getting hurt are extremely extremely reduced. And so that's kind of what we want to do with that area. And so a muscle adapts to what we do to it, and this is basically in strength training geek speak, the said principle, the specific adaptation to impose demands. Basically, like I said, what you do to it, the muscle will get better at that. And so strengthening a muscle through movement will get it better at movement, but it doesn't necessarily make it better at stabilization. And so this is why, like, the traditional core training stuff like crunches and back extensions and side bends, you know, they teach the core to create movement, not necessarily to resist movement and to stabilize that joint. And so that's why we've kind of had this, this new understanding and direction with the core training is because of stuff like that. So that's where things like planks and side planks and stuff like that, why they started to become more popular, and, you know, things like crunches and back extensions and stuff, luckily, have started to fall out of favor. In fact, kind of as a side note here, anyone who knows who Stuart McGill is again another well-known person in strength training circles, and he's a Canadian research scientist and basically looks at the low back. Like, that's his specialization, is, you know, what happens to the low back and you know, that joint through different movements and stuff like that. And so, you know, his work is basically what's really kind of solidified that moving the lower back, that when the lumbar spine is moving, the pressure and the load increase and the pressure increases on the discs between the vertebrae is increased just hundreds of percentage points. And so, you know, that's not what we want to be putting those sensitive, spinal discs through. I mean, you've only got one spine, and you got to live with it through the rest of your life. And so you don't want to be doing stuff that's going to be placing excessive strain on it and wearing out the discs that are so important for, you know, having a good lower back that functions in a pain-free manner. And so anyway, so it's not really, science has shown us that there's really not a whole lot of debate that, do we need to reduce movement-based stuff to zero? You know, I don't know. Personally, I definitely minimize it and have most of my people that I train doing close to zero. But, you know, like I said, the evidence is definitely there, both real world and in the lab, that the vast majority of your training for the low back area is definitely wanting to be stabilization stuff or stabilization based. And so, and then again, just to touch on something, you know, sometimes people ask me, you know, what about the Swiss ball? And, you know, a lot of people are talking about, you know, the fact that oh, you know, the Swiss ball is supposed to be good for core training, and so now you got people who get a Swiss ball and they're doing, you know, crunches and stuff on it, and it's, you know, the idea is that it's taking your lower back through a greater range of motion, and so therefore it's actually better than just crunches on the floor. And, you know, which, again, is not necessarily the case. In fact, something that will increase your ability to create movement at the low back is probably not better, is probably worse. And so what has happened is, again, this is another one of those things that has been, you know, kind of bastardized in the typical American fashion. And, I don't know this for sure, but I know in my use of the Swiss ball, that it definitely promotes core stability, but not as a direct core training method. And so, like I said, like doing crunches and side bends and stuff and back extensions on a ball doesn't make those exercises more functional. What you can use, though, the Swiss ball for is, like, you know, in my facility, I use it in place of a bench. So instead of having somebody lay down on a bench, I'll have them, you know, roll out on a ball and where they're basically in a tabled position with their, you know, legs bent and feet flat on the floor and their upper back and head supported by the Swiss ball. And that's what, you know, how you can use the Swiss ball to get more core training and stuff out of simple exercises, you know, instead of sitting on a bench, you know, sitting on a Swiss ball. And so that is how, you know, I think the Swiss ball was actually intended to be used to promote core stabilization and, you know, core training and stuff. But, you know, we get a hold of the thing and all of a sudden it's like, hey, look at this. I can make my abs burn even more by doing crunches on this thing. This is great. And so then all of a sudden we got a whole generation of trainers out there who are doing core training by having people do crunches and stuff on a Swiss ball. So that's not exactly what we're talking about with core training and why those things aren't necessarily better. And so, you know, so that's kind of the idea. We want to make sure that we are training that low back area to stabilize, but also in that core training, like I said, this, we also include our hips and our upper back area as well. So we want to have mobile hips. We want to have a mobile thoracic spine, basically our, you know, right above that, you know, the low back. And we want to have stable shoulders and, you know, particularly the shoulder blades. And the shoulder blades are kind of the key to shoulder stability and being able to pull your shoulder blades down and back and keep them stabilized while you create movement at the arms. And if you'll notice, most people, as soon as they start doing, you know, some sort of bench pressing motion or overhead pressing motion or something like that, their shoulders will basically come up and forward a little bit, and they'll rise away from the torso. And in kettlebell lifting, they call it keeping your shoulders packed. You want to keep your shoulders packed into your torso. You want them to be part of your torso, not elevated up and away so that they're kind of their own entity. And so, again, the key to the shoulder stabilization is being able to stabilize the shoulder blades and keep them pulled down and back, and that's usually what's lacking in that area. And so we also want to, you know, look at that, and, you know, why is that important? You know, some people may wonder, well, shoot, you know, if I'm doing, you know, planks and side planks and stuff like that, then why do I need to be worried about these other areas like that? And realistically, movement is the ultimate dictator of true core strength. And what I mean by that is if one joint is dysfunctional, it will affect all other joints. And so, for example, you can have the most stable core in the world from just a direct, you know, core training or, you know, ab lower back area from just training that directly with exercises like planks and stuff like that. But if you have hips that aren't mobile enough, then what's going to happen is your body will coax that extra movement out of your lower back. And so it doesn't matter how stable it is in the gym. As soon as you start moving and you start connecting joints together, all that's going to go out the window. And so, you know, for example, when you're bending down to pick something up, everybody's told you, you know, lift with your legs and not your lower back. I mean, you should be able to come down in like a deadlift type position. And so, you know, I've got, you know, video demo of a deadlift on my blog at bikejames.com. If you haven't seen it, you definitely need to check it out. But basically the concept behind the deadlift is being able to shift your hips back behind your heels and let your chest come down towards the ground. And so that is a deadlift position. And getting those hips back behind the heels is what we're looking for also on our bikes, which I'll get into here more in just a little bit. But if you don't have that hip mobility, then what's going to happen is your hips are going to stop sliding back, and they're going to start dropping straight down towards the ground, and you're going to start rounding at the lower back when that happens. And so, you know, again, this is why, you know, we want to do some core training stuff, but we also want to do these full body movements like deadlifts so that we can integrate that core stability with the mobility and movement from these other joints. And so, you know, same thing with the thoracic spine, the upper back. You know, if we're not mobile with that, most people, you know, especially in today's society, we tend to have a little bit of a caved chest posture. You know, the shoulders are up and rounded forward, and the chest is kind of caved in a little bit. You know, we want to be able to, you know, push the bottom of our sternum forward and have, you know, get a straight back. We don't want that upper back, you know, rounded, you know, like what comes with the caved chest posture. And so a lot of people just simply can't do that. Like, they can't get their upper back in that position. And so, again, if you can't create the mobility in a certain area, then your body will sacrifice stability at another joint in order to allow you to move. And so that's just a really important concept for you to understand the overall, you know, gist of core training, because, you know, ultimately core training is dictated, or core strength is dictated by how well you move and you can maintain proper core stability and position and stuff around these other mobile joints. And so this also kind of touches on something real quick, that, you know, pain is where pain shows up is usually not where the problem is. And so, you know, for example, when people get low back pain, it's not necessarily that the low back is weak. A lot of times what happens is the hips aren't mobile enough, and so you're having to get too much movement out of the lower back. Or when you're sitting on your bike, for example, if you can't shift your hips back and maintain a relatively straight lower back and you've got your lower back rounded, that's just a bad position for it to be in to try to be stabilizing for you to pedal and create movement around. And so it basically, low back pain generally comes from you putting your low back into a bad position and using it to create movement in order to compensate for the hips' lack of movement. And so, you know, same thing with the shoulders and the rotator cuff. Like, this is another area that, you know, in my work with mountain bikers, it's actually kind of a common thing for mountain bikers to have some sort of shoulder and rotator cuff pain and tendonitis and stuff like that. And again, a lot of that comes not necessarily from the shoulders and the rotator cuff being weak, but from an inability to stabilize the shoulder blades and being able to keep the shoulders pulled back and down. Your rotator cuff attaches to your shoulder blade. And so if your shoulder blades, the muscles that are supposed to stabilize them, aren't doing their job, then that's creating more of a demand on the rotator cuff, and so that's why the rotator cuff starts to get weak and you know, worn out, and you start to develop shoulder problems and stuff like that. So again, you know, all these people who've got shoulder issues and they're out there doing, you know, rotator cuff work and stuff like that, they're not really addressing the root cause of the problem. So pain is usually a symptom of a bigger problem. And, you know, like I said, the reason I bring that up is because, you know, a lot of people who are in on this call, I'm sure, are interested in being able to reduce, you know, and eliminate low back fatigue and low back pain. And like I said, it's not going to happen just from training the abs and the lower back. You also have to look at how these other joints are functioning and how that's affecting how the abs and low back function as well. So that's just, you know, basically kind of a primer on where I'm coming from with core training. So again, just to recap real quick, you know, the core is your platform from which you create movement. And so, you know, it also includes your upper back and your hips. It's, you know, not a muscle group, but a collection of muscles and how they function together. And so that's what we want to look at. And so that's how we want to train them. And also remember that, you know, not all joints want to be mobile. The low back, the lumbar spine area, wants to be stable, so that's how we want to train it. But we want to ultimately put it into, you know, big movement patterns that get us to have to stabilize at the core and create movement at the hips. And so that's what's going to help us become better mountain bikers. And so, so now we'll get into the you know, the good stuff. You know, how does this apply to mountain biking? you want to gain core stability and hip mobility and strength. That's the basic gist behind mountain bike core training. And the reason for this is that the rounded low back position is it's a weak position and can cause a lot of wear and tear on the lower back. And so if you can't get your hips back, like I was talking about earlier, if you can't get your hips back and keep your lower back relatively straight, then you're going to be causing a lot of wear and tear on that low back. And so the better position you can get your low back into, the stronger platform you will have, and that means the more power you can display. And so this also gets into something that, you know, I tell people that train with me in my facility, is that there's really no difference between training for injury prevention and training for performance enhancement. Because the reality is the same dysfunctions that cause pain also rob you of strength and power. So, you know, like I said, your low back may be sore, but what's really happening is that you are losing strength and power with your legs because your low back's in a bad position. And conversely, if you want to gain more power with your legs, you may not have low back pain, but you need to look at how is that core functioning, you know, how is it all working together? Because if you're not able to keep your, you know, that low back in a good, strong, stable position, then you're never going to be able to maximize your strength and power output from your legs because you're going to have a compromised platform that you're trying to work from. And so the two things go totally hand in hand. And so so the hips are our biggest, strongest muscle in the lower body, and getting them to contribute to pedaling will greatly increase pedaling power. And this is, you know, a really important concept because most cyclists are quad dominant. They're really good at knee extension, emphasized exercises and sitting down and pedaling, and which you know definitely emphasizes knee extension, but they're not as good as hip extension at hip extension. And so the hips, like I said, are your strongest muscle in your body. So if you want to increase your lower body power, the fastest way to do that is to get your hips into pedaling more. And so it's not just a matter of, well, let's just get our quads stronger. You know, you need to look at where the weak link in lower body movement is. And for most cyclists, it's the hips. And so, you know, particularly the glutes and the hamstrings. And so those are the muscles that you want to get stronger and that you want to really get, you know, cranking in the pedaling, you know, pedaling power stuff. And so, you know, by creating a stronger platform to display your power from and increasing your ability to create power, then you greatly increase your pedaling power. And so that's, you know, the name of the game. If you can pedal harder, you can turn over bigger gears, you can, you know, sprint up climbs and it won't take as much out of you. You'll just be faster. The other thing that this will do is it'll also save your low back and wear and tear on the knee joint. Because here's the downfall of the quad-dominant movement and quad-dominant pedaling, is that your knee joints are this small, teeny little joint. And your hip joints are this big joint surrounded by big muscles. Which one of those two joints do you think is intended to create, you know, most of the power behind lower body movement? You know, just from a logical standpoint, without anybody knowing anything about functional anatomy and stuff, it's pretty easy to say that the hips are stronger than the knee joint. And the hips, therefore, are what was intended for us to use more than the knee joint. And so the knee joint wears out relatively quickly when you switch that emphasis from moving at the hips to moving at the knees. And so, you know, that's why getting the hips into it is so important, because it's not only going to save your lower back, but it's also going to save your knees as well. And so, which is also another, you know, big concern for a lot of riders. It's not just low back pain, but also knee pain and stuff like that. And so, again, if you can get your knees out of the equation a little bit and get your hips taking over more of it, then we can save some of that. So, but there's also some things that are unique to mountain biking and particularly standing pedaling. And this is actually something that I've been, you know, thinking about a lot lately and just really realizing there are some fundamental yeah, sorry about that. I had a call trying to come in. There's some fundamental difference between road riding and mountain biking. And one of those basic differences is the fact that with road riding, you can basically sit most of the time. And with mountain biking, we have to stand to pedal a lot more. In fact, most of the time when I'm talking to riders, it's not seated pedaling efforts where they feel like they're really taxed and worn out. It's the standing pedaling efforts. It's where they got to stand up and sprint up a climb, or they're in a technical trail section, or you know, a technical climb where it doesn't lend itself to just keeping your butt in the seat. And as soon as you stand up, your core is engaged a lot more. When you're sitting down, basically the seat and seat post can kind of create some of that platform for your legs. As soon as you stand up, you've lost that. And so now your core is pretty much completely responsible for creating that platform with your legs. And as soon as you stand as well, it changes your body position, and now you get away from more of a quad-dominant position into more of a hip-dominant position. And basically, climbers, good guys who can stand up and just, you know, romp up a hill are able to keep their core stable and drive into the pedals with their hips. And what happens with most riders, though, is they don't have that strong, stable core, so they stand up, and they don't have that strong platform. You know, their hips are shifting from side to side, and their body's trying to figure out, well, how do I use my quads to create this movement? Because that's what it's used to doing. And so, you know, this is one of the reasons that, you know, just kind of on a side note, why I say that if you're a downhill racer or a downhill rider or, you know, four-cross rider, then if your butt's in the seat, that's not training, because, you know, you're basically laying fitness on the wrong movement pattern. And so, again, it's another one of those reasons why, you know, downhill riders and four-cross riders don't need to be spending time on a road bike in the off-season with their butt in the seat, you know, pedaling. It just it cracks me up, like, how many times I've heard people say, man, when I get tired, I just want to sit down. It's like, well, dude, that's where you spend the vast majority of your training time, is with your butt in the seat. What do you expect? So so you need to get your butt out of the seat and work that core training. This is also one of the reasons why single speeding has gotten a reputation as a way to increase core strength and lower body power. Again, there's nothing magical about single speeding. It's just that the one gear forces you to get your butt up out of the seat more and to use the hips. And so, you know, it is a good training tool. But again, if you understand why it works, instead of just attributing magical powers to a single speed, then you can figure out, well, okay, now I can take these, you know, this understanding and use it in my other parts of my training program to, you know, get even more of a training effect in that area. So the standing pedaling thing is huge for us. And so you want to train your weak link, and for most of us, that's what the weak link is, that ability to get up out of the saddle and romp and put a lot of power into the pedals. And so what happens, as soon as you stand up, then we pedal one leg at a time. And the way that our body's set up, it works in a sling. Like, basically our right side lower body works in connection with our left side upper body. And so when you go to pedal with your right leg, you're actually asking the left side of your core, your left oblique and that side of your core to clamp down to create the platform for your leg to create the power from. And so that's what we're trying to do, you know, kind of what the idea behind core training to increase pedaling power. It's not just, you know, the core stability itself. It's how does that core connect with the opposite hip? You know, how does the left side of the core connect with the opposite hip? And so what you'll, you know, notice is you probably will find that your hips, when you stand up to pedal, tend to kind of shift from side to side and sway a little bit. And what that is the core weakness displaying itself. Some of the power that you're trying to put down into the pedal is being leaked by your core shifting to the side. And so if you can get your core stronger and get it to resist that movement, then all of the power that you're trying to put down into the pedal is now going down into the pedal. And so, you know, that's why, you know, you have to work on core strength, and you have to work on how the hip and the core interact with each other in order to maximize your pedaling power. And so, you know, this, some of the stuff you just can't do on your bike. You have to get off of your bike and get into the gym and do some of this stuff you know, in a controlled environment like the gym, so that you can gain better control and better understanding of what's going on with the, you know, how the core functions and stuff for your on your bike. And so, so that is, you know, basically kind of one of the main reasons that mountain bikers need core strength and realistically need more core strength than a road cyclist does. And so, you know, when we get this whole, you know, does strength training really help increase, you know, cycling ability and stuff like that? You got to remember that pretty much all these studies that question it at all have been done on road cyclists. And so we're a different breed. We're a different animal. And so you have to look at, you know, what is most of your trail riding like? You know, where's your weak points at? And so, again, that standing pedaling is definitely a big part of it. But there's also some more things. And one of the things, another thing that really separates mountain biking from road cycling is the amount of hip mobility that we need. And so, you know, when you stand up, you don't want to just stand straight up on your bike, you know, especially when you're going downhill and getting into technical sections. What you want to do is get into, you know, what a lot of skills coaches call the attack position. And that is where you've got your butt pushed back, you've got your chest down towards your handlebars, you've got your back straight, and, you know, your elbows are out to the side a little bit. And so that's a good, strong attack position. And like I said, a lot of riders simply can't achieve that position. They don't have the core strength or the hip mobility to get into that position. So what they end up doing is they end up rounding their lower back and dropping their butt straight down and actually keeping their chest too tall. And so now they've got their weight distributed in a bad way. And that's why a lot of riders have trouble, you know, with going over the handlebars and stuff like that, is because they're not able to get their center of gravity, their butt, far enough back behind the handlebars in order to, you know, keep them in a nice stable position. And so, you know, that's why the hip mobility is a huge thing. Again, a, you know, road cyclist doesn't need to worry about that as much. But the other thing that we got to worry about is lateral hip mobility and strength, and basically the ability for our hips to move side to side. And the reason that that's important for us is cornering. And so cornering does not come from turning your handlebars. It comes from leaning your bike over. And so, again, I'm not, you know, a skills coach, and there's guys that can explain this concept a lot better than I can. But, again, you know, the basic idea is, like, if you are pedaling your bike with no hands on the handlebars, you can still steer your bike by just leaning it slightly from side to side. And you notice kind of how the handlebars will kind of, you know, flop just a little bit to accommodate the lean. And that's how you're able to steer without hands. And it's the same basic concept on the trail. You know, even though you got your hands on the handlebars, you're not turning the handlebars. You're leaning the bike, and what you're actually doing is letting the bars, you know, flop and the wheel flop like it needs to compensate for the lean, and you're hanging on to the handlebars to, you know, help keep it in that position, you know, as trail obstacles and stuff are trying to knock your front wheel out of alignment and stuff. And so, anyways, when you lean your bike over, you have to be able to shift your hips over in the opposite direction to counterbalance the lean. The whole idea behind keeping traction on your tires, you know, a lot of people are afraid to lean their bikes because they feel like they're just going to slide out, and they can't keep traction when they do that. Well, what's happening is they're leaning their bike, but they're also leaning their center of gravity with the bike. You need to keep your center of gravity lined up over the center of gravity of the bike, and that's what keeps traction on between your wheels and the trail. And so, you know, like I said, how that happens is when you lean your bike, you've actually got to be able to shift your hips, you know, to the opposing side. So if you're leaning to the left, you need to be able to shift your hips to the right in order to counterbalance that lean. And so, you know, and also if you watch, like, a lot of the best downhill riders in the world, they will actually initiate a lot of turns, especially like sharp turns and stuff like that, with their hips. It's like they're throwing their hips first, and then their bike follows their hips. And so that ability to shift the hips back and forth and side to side is extremely important for us in order to be able to corner properly and create, be able to keep in a good position and counterbalance the lean and stuff like that. And so, and it all actually stems from that attack position. If you can't get into your attack position, your hips are already in the wrong position. So good luck trying to figure out how to corner with your hips already in a bad position. So, you know, again, that's what we're looking at when we're trying to figure out, okay, how does all this core training stuff apply to mountain biking? And so, you know, hip mobility, core stability, are huge aspects of that. And so, basically, you know, that's kind of the idea. I mean, those are the main concepts that I look at when I'm looking at mountain biking. I'm looking at what are the trail skills that we need, what are the movement patterns behind that, now how do we create a training program to improve those movement patterns? And so this is what we need, so this is what the training program should reflect. And so some of my favorite exercises for are the basic, what I call like an ab sequence or a core activation sequence. And again, there's a video demo of this on my blog at bikejames.com. But, you know, basically a plank, a side plank on each side, and then what's known as a bird dog, basically where you're on your hands and knees, all fours, hands and knees, and then you extend one leg back and the opposite arm out. And so you're basically stabilizing yourself on the floor with the, you know, opposite knee and hand. And so, you know, those three exercises are kind of a good basis for, you know, core training. And so the plank is obviously just working on your ability to stabilize at the core and keep your low back in a good, strong, stable position. But even with the plank, you know, this is something I talk about in the video demo, you know, a lot of people, again, miss out on the fact that the upper back is part of the core. And so when you're doing planks, you have to have your shoulders packed into your torso. You have to have your shoulder blades pulled back and down. And so a lot of times I see people doing planks, and I'm like, oh, I can do a plank for 5 minutes. Like, man, you can't even do a plank for 30 seconds. Let me show you how to get your shoulders in the right position. And then all of a sudden it's like they can't even hold themselves in that position for 30 seconds. So if you're doing planks and you've got your upper back rounded and your shoulders hunched up towards your ears, that's not a plank. And so, you know, you need to be able to, you know, keep the whole torso, you know, the whole core nice and stable for the plank. You know, the side plank where you're basically on your side with your, you know, line on your elbow underneath your shoulder, and then you raise your hips up off of the floor, and, you know, that's working on that lateral core strength that I was talking about, you know, the ability to resist movement from side to side. And so like I was talking about with the pedaling and being able to resist that movement when you're pedaling with your right leg, you know, having the left side of the core resist the movement, so more of the power is going into the pedal. And so, and then the third exercise, the bird dog, is even taking that, you know, one step further. And so what you're doing is working on that rotational core stability. And so when you, I guarantee you what happens, you know, 9 times out of 10 with this exercise is as soon as somebody extends one leg back and the opposite arm out, their hips slide over towards the support knee, the knee that's still on the ground, their hips will shift over to that side. And so what you've got to do is make sure that you're really locking down that opposing side. So if you're going to extend your right leg back, you need to make sure that you've really got the left side of your core locked down and locked down hard. And the visual that you want to have is that you're trying to lock your rib cage down to your pelvis. And so get that locked down and then extend that leg back and make sure that you're squeezing your glute as you extend that leg back. And so that's how you're, you know, really work on resisting that movement. And so that's how you're working on that specific function that we're looking for, being able to extend the leg back and have that core resist it. And so that's a good, you know, a good basic exercise and kind of how they apply to mountain biking. You know, another one of my favorite exercises are the Saxon side bends. And, you know, this is actually an exercise that if anybody caught my, I think it was my last article in Decline magazine, or 2 articles ago, I was talking about some core training stuff and had this exercise featured. But basically a Saxon side bend is where you're standing with your feet a little wider than shoulder width apart, and you press 2 dumbbells overhead. And then what you do is you're doing a lateral body bend. You're leaning from side to side. But you have to make sure that you're initiating the lean from the hips. And so you're not just diving your shoulders to the side what you're doing is you're pushing your hips to the side and then leaning in the opposite direction. So if you're wanting to lean to your right, you initiate the movement by pushing your hips to the left and then allowing your shoulders to lean over to the right. And then to bring yourself back to center, you push your hips back to center, and that brings your shoulders up and gets you back to standing up tall, and then you just do that to the opposite direction. And so that lateral hip shift of moving the hips from side to side and concentrating on the hips driving the movement is where we're going to get that specific strength for cornering that I was talking about, and also working on some hip mobility and your ability to slide those hips from side to side and initiate movement from the hips. And so that's where a really good exercise to work on that movement comes from. And so again, we're not leaning at the lower back. A lot of people look at this exercise and think that we're doing like a side bend, but holding weights over our head, and that's not it at all. You're actually, again, locking your rib cage down to your pelvis and resisting movement at the low back area and creating the movement at the hips. And so that's the key to getting the most out of this exercise for mountain biking. And then obviously there's a lot of other exercises and stuff that you can employ, but my last favorite one is the Turkish getup. And for anybody that has not seen this, you need to go to YouTube and you can Google Turkish getup, and you'll find hundreds of video demos. I mean, I've got one on my blog. And so you need to get familiar with the Turkish getup and its variations, because it is the ultimate core training exercise and your ability to be able to execute this exercise. And so for those of you that don't know, again, it's hard to describe, so watching a video is definitely best, but you basically start laying on the ground with your arm extended towards the ceiling, holding a weight, preferably a kettlebell, and then through a series of moves, you roll over on your elbow, and then get up on your hand, and then raise your hips off of the floor and pull one leg underneath you, and then sit yourself up straight, and then stand up. So you're basically going from a lying position to a standing position through a series of, I think it's like, seven moves or so that make up the whole get up. But within those moves, you are working on all these aspects of core strength that we want worked on. We're working on, the ability of the shoulder blade to stabilize the shoulder, because you're not going to be able to use a heavy weight in a Turkish getup without a good, strong, stable shoulder. You're going to have to stabilize at the core through a bunch of different planes. You're going to have mobile hips in order to get the hips high enough off the ground to clear enough room to get your leg under you. When you're raising yourself from that from that position there, it's kind of like that lateral hip shift and stuff. And so I'm definitely going to have to do a video kind of going into some of these concepts in more depth. But suffice it to say, Turkish getup is where it's at. And so personally, I'm at a point where when I do my core training, I pretty much do Turkish get-ups or some variation of them, because you don't have to do the whole get-up. You can do a quarter get-up where you're just, rolling over onto your elbow. You can just work on, the hip lift portion of it. And so you don't have to do the full get-up. You can actually identify where your weak link is in the get-up and then kind of work on hammering it. And so, and some bonus exercises, again, like I was saying, before, movement ultimately is going to dictate what core strength looks like. And so the deadlift, and especially the single leg deadlift, are the best exercises for us as mountain bikers to work on that. Because again, the deadlift is pushing your hips behind your heels, letting your chest come down towards the floor. That is your attack position. So if you can't get into the bottom position of a deadlift and do it in an efficient manner, then I absolutely guarantee you that you're not riding your bike properly, that you have your body in a bad compromised position, and you're trying to figure out how to ride in that bad compromised position. So that bottom position of the deadlift is extremely specific to our sport. And when you do the exercise right, when you stabilize at the core and you create the movement at the hips, basically drive your heels into the ground and think about the visual that I have people in my facility work on is pushing your butt back over the top of your feet. And that's what gets your shoulders to raise up. A lot of people, when they do the deadlift, one, they can't even get into the position properly. They got their butt too low and their chest too high, and they're basically turning it into a squat where they're holding the handlebar. A lot of people, when they initiate the movement, initiate with the lower back. You know, their chest rises away from the floor while their hips stay in the same place. And then once they've kind of, you know, raised their chest up, then they kind of start getting the legs into it. So when you first initiate from the ground on the deadlift, you don't want your trunk angle with the ground to change. And so that's what tells you that you're initiating with the legs. And that is that standing pedaling stuff that I was talking about, where your core is creating the platform and you're driving with your hips into the ground. And so that's what we're looking for in order to get better at standing pedaling. And so, again, you know, this is not just downhill or four-cross stuff. You know, if you look at your average ride, you know, especially if you're trying to ride hard, you tend to stand a lot. And, again, if you look at where in your rides are you the weakest, where do you feel like you need to improve the most, a lot of riders will say, well, you know, even cross-country riders and trail riders are going to say, well, it's where I'm having to stand. And so, again, it's you know, not just a downhill training concept. But so that's where the deadlift, and particularly the single-leg deadlift, because once you get strong on the single-leg deadlift, then you're really good, because, you know, that's a way more functional application of that movement. Because, again, when you pedal one leg at a time. You don't pedal both legs at the same time. And so that's why the single-leg deadlift is so important. And so that's basically it. You know, having a program that focuses on these concepts, you know, using some of these exercises that I've talked about, is what's going to really get you the best bang for your buck when it comes to core training for mountain biking. And so, you know, realistically, when you do it right, it's all core training, because you're strong from the inside out. And I guess that's kind of another thing that you want to, you know, get down is, you know, if you look at the martial artists understand that your limbs are not where your power comes from, and that's why they're able to, you know, these little dudes are able to, you know, have punching power that you know, just goes off the charts, you know, being able to, you know, take punches and stuff and blows that would, you know, put a much larger man down, is they understand that if you can be strong from your core and then be strong from that core out, then that's, you know, that's what we're really looking for. And so when you look at it that way, absolutely everything that you do should be core training. And so I guess, you know, in some ways, core training is a bit of a misnomer, because it all should be core training. I guess, you know, with the real, you know, are we talking about, you know, core training, you know, what type of specific core training for what, you know, particular area are we talking about? But anyway, it's kind of a little side rant there, but it's all core training if you do it right. And so that's basically it. I had a couple questions that had come in that I wanted to address here real quick. And, you know, one guy was asking about how do you know when your core is relatively weak or strong enough. And, you know, this is, you know, kind of a tough one. I would say, like, your first indication would be if your, you know, low back is hurting in or something, or if you have some sort of shoulder issue. If you got, you know, some sort of low back or shoulder issue, then I would say that it's not strong enough in the right areas and mobile enough in the right areas, and so there's some sort of dysfunction there. But if we're going to talk about, like, just some basic strength stuff, you know, we need to kind of look at the movement stuff. And so these are some things that I've been kind of mulling over in my head lately, like the Turkish getup. You know, I personally can do a Turkish getup with over 50% of my body weight. You know, I weigh about 170 some odd pounds, and, you know, I've got a video on the web of me doing a Turkish getup with a 93-pound kettlebell. Do I think everybody needs to be able to do that? You know, I don't know, but I would say that you should be able to easily execute a Turkish getup, a full getup from the floor with good form, with at least somewhere in the range of like 35 to 40% of your body weight. And, you know, when you can do that, then, you know, your core is getting strong enough. In fact, in kettlebell lifting, you know, in the old days, when somebody wanted to get into kettlebell lifting, they started them out with the, you know, with some basic exercises, and the get-up was one of them. And before they taught them how to do a kettlebell snatch, they had to develop a certain level of strength in the get-up in order to for them to develop the mobility and stability that they needed in order to execute the snatch properly. And so I think that there's something to that, you know, concept for sure. So I would say that, you know, from a Turkish get-up standpoint, being able to do 35 to 40% of your body weight, you know, closer to 50%, the better. And, you know, also with the single leg deadlift, and this is something that I've, you know, kind of been changing my mind on a bit lately is, you know, I used to talk a lot about the deadlift, and I do think that you need to have a certain amount of strength on the deadlift. I'm not exactly sure that it needs to be twice your body weight, you know, for a couple reasons. And this is another thing that, that Mike Boyle has kind of, you know, stirred up some controversy over lately is his contention that you don't need to do a lot of double leg movements, and single leg movements are better because our low back is basically set up to handle the loads from single leg movements better. And, you know, it just kind of makes sense logically. Like, how many times in life are you really, you know, exposing your low back to maximum loads with two legs? You know, a lot of times, you know, sport is pretty much one leg at a time. And so I think that single leg movements are a much better indicator of true core strength because, again, we're looking at, like, how does the core interact with the with one leg at a time, which is way more specific to sport. So, you know, I would say that being able to do a single leg deadlift with, I mean, realistically, like, you know, approaching body weight would be a, you know, a good goal. And so, you know, again, these are numbers that I'm still kind of thinking of, and you know, maybe body weight's a little bit much for some people. But, you know, I would say at least, you know, I'm just trying to think, like, I'm, you know, 170 pounds. I mean, I can easily rip off single leg deadlifts with 120, 130 pounds. So, you know, I mean, you got to, I would say, at least looking at, like, you know, 75 to 80% of body weight, being able to easily do it would be a good indicator of what your core strength, your true core strength is. Because, again, we're not just looking at, you know, the core strength itself, but we're also looking at how does that core stability interact with, you know, the rest of your body to create movement, particularly a very mountain bike specific movement. So that would kind of be my answer to those things there. I mean, you know, some people will you know, have, you know, planks, being able to hold a plank for a certain amount of time. I definitely think there's, you know, something to that. I think you should be able to easily hold a side plank. I think side plank is a little more functional, I guess, and indicative of usable core strength than just a regular plank. And so, you know, doing a side plank for, gosh, I mean, you know, at least a minute or more. I mean, if you can't hold a side plank for at least a minute, then there's definitely some issues going on there. And so, so you want to, you know, make sure you got those things addressed. And so, so that would kind of be my answer to that. You know, another guy had asked here to touch on some progressions for exercises and stuff like that, and so that's actually a good you know, good thing, because, you know, like, so with the ab sequence, there are some progressions you can do, like, you know, plank. You can progress to you know, having your feet up on a Swiss ball would make that a little harder. Progressing to having, you know, your feet on the floor and your elbows on a Swiss ball would, again, you know, be another increase. You know, somebody had actually just asked a question about some exercise recommendations with, you know, like a TRX or the Jungle Gym. And this is another thing that you could do, is you can, you know, suspend your feet in the TRX trainer or Jungle Gym and do planks. And, you know, basic same concept with the side plank, you know, putting your, you know, raising your feet off the floor. Man, doing a side plank with your feet in a Jungle Gym or TRX trainer is stinking tough, like way tougher than you think it should be. And so, you know, that's kind of a way to progress that movement. The bird dog doesn't, you know, I'm sure somebody will, you know, prove me wrong, and there are some progressions. I mean, there are some exercises. Anybody that's familiar with the Greg Cook functional movement trainer bands, it's kind of a specialized band, and you can actually rig that up to create some resistance in the movement of the bird dog exercise. So that would be a way to kind of progress that. You know, the Saxon side bend, it's actually interesting that was asked, because the Saxon side bend, if I was going to look at a progression for that, I would actually say that what you'd want to start out with, side plank would be the first thing, then moving to a side bridge, which is basically a moving side plank where you're not just coming up and holding holding that side plank position for an amount of time, but you're coming up, holding it for a second, and then lowering your hips back down to the ground, and then raising back up and holding it for a second and lowering yourself back down. So you're basically doing reps like that, which again is a lot tougher than you would think that it should be. And so, you know, that would progress into the Saxon side bend. And then that would actually kind of be used in conjunction with a side press. And a side press is one of my favorite upper body exercises. It's basically a shoulder press with a lateral body bend. And so it's kind of like the Saxon side bend meets a shoulder press. And then that's actually leading us to what I consider to be the ultimate exercise in this progression. And again, what we're trying to work on with this progression is the lateral core strength and also the lateral hip mobility that we're needing for cornering. And so the windmill, the kettlebell windmill exercise, is in my opinion, kind of the ultimate in that progression. It requires a lot of hip mobility and a lot of core stability. And so, again, I don't have anything really prepared to demonstrate that. It's a little difficult to explain, on the teleconference. But again, you can do a search on YouTube for kettlebell windmill, and I'm sure you'll find plenty of demos. And so, again, this is something I'll have to do a video demo here and get posted here in the next couple weeks to kind of go over that. But so that would be kind of the progression for that. And then the Turkish getup has its own inherent progressions if you do it right. And again, I just, we've just bastardized some good training concepts here in this country. And unfortunately, some of the biggest culprits behind this are like these, boot camp workout, let's get everybody in here and they're just all going to do the same thing. We're all going to start with these. Everybody just starts doing Turkish get-ups right off the bat. There's no progression into it, and that's not – nobody comes into my facility and does a Turkish get-up the first day. It's the best exercise there is, but you're not going to do it the first day. You're going to show me that you can you basically have to earn your right to do a full get-up. And so some of the basic progressions for a get-up are, like a get-up sit-up, which is basically like a straight leg sit up, where you're when you're lying down on the ground, you're holding, a weight, preferably, two kettlebells, out towards the ceiling. Your arms are up towards the ceiling, and then as you sit up, you basically keep your arms pointed straight up towards the ceiling. So there's some shoulder mobility and stability involved in there as well. And so, so that's really like one of the first exercises that you want to get going on. And then a kettlebell arm bar, which is, again, I've got a good video demo on my blog for that exercise. That would be the next progression. And then working into a quarter get-up, where you're basically just working on your ability to roll over onto your elbow. And a lot of people do that wrong. They can get up on their elbow, but what they end up doing is they end up driving their elbow into the ground and pushing themselves up, as opposed to using their core to sit up. And so that's why the get-up sit-up is the first part of that progression, because you've got to get the core strong enough to sit up, because you don't want to be rolling over on your elbow by just driving the elbow into the ground and picking yourself up that way. So, working on that, and then, working on, the hip drill, like basically for those of you that are familiar with it, with the Turkish get-up, the move where you've got to lift your hips off of the floor and then pull the leg that's still out straight underneath you. And so, again, like that's a progression. And then finally, standing up. And so, the Turkish get-up comes with its own inherent progressions if you if you do it right and you don't just rush into the full getup. And so so those are some different, you know, progressions and stuff that you can use with these exercises that I've talked about here. And then you know, for my my guy Zach in San Francisco is wondering about the TRX or Jungle Gym exercises. I mean, there's, man, I love the Jungle Gym. I mean, it's I think I mentioned in a recent blog post, you know, I picked one up a few months ago, and I don't know how I've gotten by without it. It's just such an awesome piece of equipment. And so, like, one of my favorite new moves on it is the single arm inverted row. That's just an awesome move, and such core strength, such, you know, upper body pulling strength and stuff involved with that. That's a great move. I mean, pretty much anything you do on that, I mean, that's kind of the whole concept behind suspension training, is that it just creates a more of a core demand because it's a little bit more unstable or unstable. And so even doing like a Bulgarian split squat or a, you know, a rear elevated split squat, as, you know, some people call it, with your foot, instead of being elevated on a bench or a chair, having it elevated in the TRX trainer or the Jungle Gym is great. And, you know, that's a super hard move. I mean, you can, like I'd already mentioned, doing like planks and side planks with the feet in the suspended in the TRX or Jungle Gym. So that's you know, some ideas there. I mean, that's, you know, without, I mean, pretty much anything that you do on that is going to be a good, you know, have some good core training demands and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's just an awesome tool all the way around. So that would be, kind of my answer for that. So, so I'm going to actually unmute right now and see if anybody has called in and if they have any questions or anything like that. If, you know, anybody else on the webcast has any questions, you know, go ahead and get them in real quick, because I'm going to wrap up here in just a few minutes. I think we've, you know, covered a lot of good stuff and, you know, some good concepts and stuff like that. So hopefully you guys have learned some things and got some different understanding of what you can be doing with your core training for mountain biking and stuff. So hold on here just a second. I'm going to unmute the phone. All right. So, have anybody on the live line yet? No, cool. All right, just a bunch of webcast attendees, which is fine with me. It's why I do this. So, all right. So, well, I guess that's about it. If anybody else has any, you know, questions, like I said, you know, got another couple seconds. I'll check and see if anything else is coming in, but. No, I think that's about it. So, well, right on, guys. Well, I really appreciate everybody that took the time to listen in live, and I'll be getting the replay out to everybody. So if you guys want to listen to it again, if you missed any part of it, and if you guys think of any questions or anything like that on that, I mean, you know, my email address at james@mtbstrengthcoach.com. You know, send me that, and I'll you know, put it together and probably do a blog post on or something like that. So. So once again, it's been James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems, and I appreciate everybody taking time to listen to this, and it's been Mountain Bike Core Training Teleseminar, and I will talk to everybody next time.